The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. Indeed, I am back in New York City today for the first time in about 81 days. Nice to be here. I'm in our studio on the Upper West Side and broadcasting to all the affiliates carrying this program throughout the world, and I welcome all of you. Today, I'm not going to have a guest, in part because my normal 7 o'clock program tonight, the Progressive Commentary Hour, is going to have Chris Hedges in a three-hour discussion, one of the most provocative and important ones that you will ever hear. If you want to hear a real progressive talk about what's wrong with the world and what we have to do to make it right, that's going to be it. So instead today, I'm going to begin our new year with an in-depth original investigative report, Gardasil, Child Abuse by Big Pharma. That will come instead of our guest segment later in the program. The latest on health and healing, and 7 reasons America's mental health industry is a threat to our sanity, by Bruce Levine from Aldernet. One of the projects I intend to put into full force this year is an examination through articles, investigative reports, and a documentary, plus programs, of how we have allowed the so-called mental health field to diagnose people with conditions that simply do not exist, and then to turn around and drug them, and frequently without that person's will, actually institutionalizing them, and how the government has been co-opted by lobbyists representing the pharmaceutical industry to do this, and why your physicians, psychiatrists, have not stood up for you. In fact, everyone has been against you on this. They've all been a part of it. So I'm going to spend the whole year challenging them. And bit by bit, with each piece of information, I believe at least this audience will know that you don't have bipolar. You don't have all these conditions. These are myths. We have problems in life. Or we have brain injury. But we don't all walk around with a brain chemical imbalance that then means that we are candidates for a drug. I'm going to start by showing you how bad it is. This is from Mike Barrett. It says, antidepressants cause your arteries to thicken 400% more than normal aging does. I'll quote this. Depression may be the worst emotional experience there is. The causes are many, and it often drives people to zigzag past everything that matters and into a pill bottle of pharmaceutical treatments. But these solutions offered by the pharmaceutical industry are nothing but a sham, and their antidepressant products only make you more depressed and trigger suicidal thoughts. One study has also found that antidepressants cause your arteries to thicken 400% more than aging. A main factor in the thickening of arteries is antidepressants. The study was conducted by Emory University School of Medicine on 500 middle-aged male twins, both who served in the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. The researchers noted that among the pairs of twins were only one brother who was on antidepressants, and the one ingesting the drugs usually had higher carotid intima media thickness, IMT, the thickness of the main arteries in the neck. And then it went on to talk about this in some depth, and that the antidepressants only made the problems worse, including with suicide. That's just the first of what is going to be a lot of information on why you should think twice before you take your antidepressants. By the way, I am broadcasting still from our studio, video streaming. You can watch this program if you choose by going to GaryKnoll.com. You can watch it. Our new studio, which is really going to be spectacularly beautiful, right up there, equal to CNN and Fox, will be done in about 2 weeks. Now, parsley is generally not eaten by the average person. more often than not, it's a decoration that's used at the side of a dish, and people push it off to the side. Well, they should be eating it. Here's why. This is from the University of Tokyo. It says, the antioxidants within parsley have an extremely powerful effect and are very important, especially if you've been eating any fatty foods. And it helps protect the body against the free radicals that are caused by the fatty foods and turns off inflammation and inflammation disorders, which can then protect you from cardiovascular disease and cancers. Previous research found that the antioxidants in this help grab cadmium and heavy metals in the body and help take them out. In other words, natural chelation. But that's also true for most of your dark green vegetables. For example, one of the things I suggest people use who have been painters or craftspeople working with heavy metals, especially anything that's a volatile chemical where they're smelling it, is that they're going to have some heavy metals. So when you get them taking wheatgrass, and generally you start small, you start with 1 2-ounce cup per day, and then after a month you add 2 little ounce cups, and then a third, and you get it up to 6 ounces of wheatgrass a day, and then you start adding in like watercress. That's one of the single most powerful things you can take in to detoxify your body. But watercress, lemon, including the whole skin and seed, and parsley. But then you dilute that with apple or cucumber, and you have that 3 times a day. And if you use R-alpha-lipoic acid, the R fraction of alpha-lipoic acid, that really chelates. Now, it's not as powerful as the intravenous chelation therapy, but then again, you're spending $75 to $150 for that, and you have to take about 20 minutes to an hour sitting in a chair. You have to get to the doctor's office and out. Well, think how much better it is when you don't have to do that and you can still chelate. So the dark green vegetables, especially parsley, juice them. For the women who would like to do more to help reduce breast cancer risk, the Journal of Women's Health took a look at hormonal changes that are linked with breast cancer and how those are reduced when you consume red wine or grape juice. Now, of course, red wine and grape juice contain the same nutrient, resveratrol, and it was shown that that helps reduce the risk of breast cancer substantially. That's good news. My suggestion would be 250 milligrams of resveratrol per day to help reduce your risk of breast cancer. Increase flavonoid consumption associated with reduced cardiovascular deaths. Now, this is from the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Here's what it says. That when you have more of the flavonoids, and by the way, flavonoids are plant-based phytochemicals that may be responsible for reducing heart disease and cancer and diabetes. Quite simply, the more fruits and vegetables you consume, the more flavonoids you get. Well, this was an American Cancer Society and Tufts University research program looking at 38,000 men, 60,000 women who had no history of heart disease, and they were in this Cancer Prevention 2 nutrition study, and they found that the more of the flavonoids, now, by the way, flavonoids, you have several classes. You have the flavonoids, including flavon-3, ols, and flavonones, and flavones, and flavanols, and isoflavones, and anthocyanidins, and proanthocyanidins. They're all a part of the plant food. So when you have things such as blueberries in the morning, a bowl of blackberries, throw in some pomegranate into a smoothie, you're getting your flavonoids. You can also get them by eating onions. I'm a big believer that a half a raw sweet onion a day keeps a stroke away, because the onion, first, it has sulfur-bearing nutrients that destroy viruses and bacteria in your body. That's good. Secondly, it lowers blood pressure, That's really good. It thins the blood, much like aspirin, but without any of the bleeding that aspirin causes, up to 14 to 24,000 deaths a year just from aspirin. So an onion doesn't do any of that. It's all good. So you're getting your flavonoids that way also. And grapes, lots of flavonoids in grapes. Quote, here's what it says. The subjects were followed for 7 years, and then they examined their overall death rate and found that you had an 18% lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease compared to those who took the least amount of the flavonoid-rich foods. Now, mind you, these weren't people who were juicing. These weren't vegans. These were not people who were also taking other supplements that worked together, enhanced the flavonoid utilization in the body. Just your regular person. So think about those of you who are taking a lot of good nutrients. You're doing a lot of good. And finally, some practical advice. And this is for one of the people who I met in a juice bar in a little town that I wouldn't have thought it had a juice bar, but a little tiny town in the middle of nowhere. I pull over, and I see it says juices. So I go in, and sure enough, they had some organic stuff, not a lot, but and a little old tiny juice extractor, kind that I used to use a long time ago, where you get one little one glass, and then you got to stop it and take off the top, and a little basket in there, and you got to clean out the basket. But they had a separate little waste disposal with for the pulp, and then they keep it in this kind of sterile environment, and they make a soup with it, which is really good too, because all that pulp that you have left over, A, it's great as a compost, B, it's terrific for putting into a soup or to muffins, because there's still lots of nutrients in it, and of course all that good fiber, the lignocellulose. So this guy, he's saying, that's an awful lot of juice you're asking for. I said, yeah, well, I'm going to be driving, I take it with me. I drink it throughout the day. And he said, are you into health? I said, yeah, I'm into health. And he said, I got a question for you. He said, we know that we have a lot of toxins that we come into contact with. Do you have an answer of what you could do to get those toxins out of your body? I said, well, there's two things. First, why try to get them out before you prevent them going in? And I said, take a look around at all the plastic that you use. I said, look behind you. All those herbs, you're storing in plastic. And it's hot here. The plastic heats up. Volatile chemicals called VOCs, these are volatile organic compounds. And organic is only the chemical definition. It doesn't mean good, it means bad. And these are found in air fresheners and carpet cleaners and disinfectants. So get a product now that says no or low VOC. So now you're preventing it from getting in there. Now, how many times have you seen people out here in this hot area have plastic water? You're outside biking or hiking. That water's up around 100 degrees. If the ambient air is 100, it's going to be 100 degrees in that bottle. That means your water's filled with those chemicals. That means those chemicals come in the body. Also, you're lucky. You know, you're cleansing your body with organic juices, but you're heavy on the carrot. I don't even use carrot juice. Carrot juice spikes your blood sugar. And I said, what's your blood sugar? He said, I don't know. I said, have you ever checked it? He said, no, I'm not diabetic. How do you know you're not pre-diabetic? I said, what do you think a healthy blood sugar should be? He says, well, my sister measures hers, and hers is good and healthy. She's around 110. I said, 110 is way high. I said, ideally, the average person should not have a fasting blood sugar above 75, not 85, and not 100, and certainly not 110. There you're pre-diabetic. It's amazing what people don't know. In any case, I said, but let's go to the fact that if you want to preserve a juice, put vitamin C into it. 1 teaspoon of vitamin C per quart. And then that will keep that, if you're not going to refrigerate it immediately, it'll keep it from going bad for a better part of a day. If it's refrigerated, it'll keep it for an extra 5 days. Now, what if you've already got all these chemicals in this? What can we do? Well, this is what I told this gentleman. I said, start with your polyphenols. Those are your plant-based antioxidants. And there's lots of research showing that they increase the liver detoxification pathways. And the best of the best is called naringin, N-A-R-I-N-G-E-N-I-N. Narin, N-A-R-I-N, genin, G-E-N-I-N. Where do you get it? Grapefruits. Not just grapefruits, but the whole grapefruit. That means the peel, the white little pulpiness inside, that's your bioflavonoids. And then the seed, that's your caprylic acid. Those volatile oils that kind of give that bitterness when you bite into a grapefruit seed. Great for stimulating a release of toxins out of the liver. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that people taking prescription drugs are told to avoid grapefruit juice. Now, there are other polyphenols with detox properties, soy protein, theoflavins from black tea. So if you have, how about combining them? Why not simply have one scoop of organic, non-genetically engineered soy protein powder, the juice from one grapefruit, and one cup of black tea, and you put it all together in a blender and blend it up. But that is a great polyphenol detox. Now, that will trap heavy metals, including those plastic pieces, and take them right out of your system, and that's good for you. Then the food you could eat, well, the two best, top of my list, broccoli and garlic. And what two better foods to eat together? And it's always best to lightly steam the broccoli because you're going to get probably 200% greater absorption if the broccoli's lightly steamed. Raw broccoli, it goes right through your body. And the broccoli is a cruciferous vegetable. And all your cruciferous vegetables, which I take every single day. I mean, I can tell you, I don't tell people how much I take because I don't want them duplicating what I do because I build up to what I do. And I don't want someone, you know, suddenly projectile vomiting like they're out of The Exorcist after trying one of my drinks. I actually had that happen once, too. I'm in the health food store, and this dude's standing beside me, and he's looking at me. He says, yeah, what's that, a green juice? I said, no, it's wheatgrass juice. Man, that's a lot of wheatgrass juice. I said, yeah, it's a lot. He said, give me one of those. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think you should be taking that kind of... Well, let's start with 2 ounces. No, no, no. If you can drink that, I can drink it. And I said, have you built up to it? He said, well, I can do it. So he said, give me the same size. This is 16 ounces of wheatgrass juice. And he did it. And he looked at me, kind of smiled, and walked outside, and suddenly he's... Whoosh, just like The Exorcist man. You got to build up to it, or you walk around with a green mouth. Anyhow... the broccoli is one of the foods that contain what are called isothiocyanates. Iso, I-S-O, thio, T-H-I-O, cyanates. C-Y-A-N-A-T-E-S, isothiocyanates. And what it is, they're reactive sulfur compounds, and they pack a power punch. Now, two of the isothiocyanates, sulforaphane and indole-3-carbinol, or I3C, are your best liver detoxifiers. So every time you have broccoli, if you lightly steam it, and then you can stir-fry it with some lightly stir-fried garlic, then all those sulfur compounds in the garlic come out, and they reverse the depletion of the intrinsic liver antioxidants. They detoxify you. Great. So you get a tasty dish, and you're detoxifying at the same time. And I would throw in what is called chlorophyllin, chloro, C-H-L-O-R-O, phyllin, P-H-Y-L-L-I-N. That's from your green leafy vegetables, and that bounds the toxins in the gut and keeps them from being absorbed. And that's why I'm telling people, always take your green juices about a half hour after a meal. Because that gives the food a chance to digest and properly go through the process of hydrolysis, where you break it down into like a thick soup. And that's why if you chew thoroughly and take your time, your food will get properly masticated. And remember, half of all good digestion is simply proper, calmly chewing and not drinking with the meal. And then after the meal, after this food is breaking down in the stomach, and then gets in the intestine, then by taking some green juice, what you're doing is you're blocking a lot of the toxins in the body from being absorbed at the same time. And one final thing, if you've been around, if you're an artist, certainly take Milk Thistle. It's been around a long time, and it's just the best single liver detoxifier. You can take in rich in polyphenols. So hopefully the gentleman at the juice bar is in better shape because of this, and you can use it as well. Before we go to our break, I'm going to give you some upcoming guests. Of course, tonight will be Chris Hedges on C-SPAN, a three-hour interview. And tomorrow, we're going to take a look at how the increase of psychiatric drugging of children is also related to Medicaid fraud and how Congress intentionally fails to act upon subcommittee findings due to lobbying pressure from the big drug industry. We'll have Jim Gottstein on, of the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights. And then the next day we have Dr. Christina Northrup on, talking about menopause. Then we have Yaoman Onren, who will be talking. He is the former Bloomberg Bureau Chief in Istanbul, talking about zombie banks that we long ago should have deconstructed and let them be reorganized. And they're still around. And then we're going to finish off with conversations with remarkable minds. We are going to look at futurist visions of our agro-ecosystem that sustains food and nutrition and traditional agricultural methods to support a growing global population in need of food. Dr. Hans Herren is one of the most respected scientists in sustainable agriculture, and he is also the critic of the new agro-industry green revolution. A complete fraud is the agro-industry green revolution, just like the original green revolution was a fraud. And he is president of the Millennium Institute. So we'll talk with him about that. After all, if you look around the world, in Spain in particular, with unemployment, official unemployment at 25%, unofficial at close to 50, a lot of younger couples, educated couples, are moving out of the cities and going to the country and growing produce. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world, and more than half of our audience are listening and watching from outside the United States. And we are going to be giving you thousands of articles in the next 12 months to help empower you, and documentaries. I just finished filming 6 documentaries, all of which will be coming out in the next 12 months. So we are accelerating the pace at which we believe that independent individuals want more tools to prepare themselves for the changes they want to make individually and also collectively. So a lot of good is coming at you, as you will see. Now, this Wednesday evening at 7 p.m., our final meeting of our anti-aging health support group. I'll be there. Look forward to all the great results, and we'll be giving those stories to the audience. Let them see what was possible in just 3 months. Then this Sunday, this coming Sunday, we will have our one and only health support group for the year. It'll be a one-month health support group. It'll start Sunday. I choose Sunday so everyone can attend at 1 o'clock just for arthritis. But you must have arthritis in order to get into it. I have a brand new protocol and a lifestyle modification that I believe will make an enormous difference, and we're going to put it to the test. And that's Sunday. If you would like to join me, if there's room available, I haven't even asked if there's even room available yet, because every one of these gets filled. You can call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. But you must have severe joint pain, swelling, loss, lack of mobility, or classically defined and diagnosed arthritis in order to get into the study. Otherwise, we wouldn't know that we've actually helped you. Joining me in studio, before we go to our special in-depth and original investigative report on Gardasil, child abuse by Big Pharma, we have Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Welcome back into the city.
Thank you.
I have a question here from Sarah. She's a college student from Boston and a regular listener to your show. She comes from a family of diehard Republicans and was extremely disturbed when she saw the Republican debates this weekend. She thought they were the most insane questions being asked, and she would have loved it if you'd been the person that was giving the questions. And she asks, what would you have asked what would you have asked Mitt Romney that would have completely destroyed him and his credibility? And what would you have asked Newt Gingrich in the same way, please?
All right. I would look at that a little differently. First, I don't believe anything that you could bring up would actually embarrass the actual followers, the true believers, either to the individual, to any of the candidates, because if they're diehard Republicans, if they're going to believe that any challenge to them is just an ad hominem attack by the liberals. So those people, you're not going to move, no matter what you give. For example, how can Newt Gingrich, who's cheated on his wives, turn around and claim to be, you know, a pillar of moral standing within their very conservative religious community? So they have to overlook all that, as they have on other issues. With Mitt Romney, it's and these people, it's not about getting their supporters to reexamine the legitimacy of their candidate, but it's for everyone else. With Romney, I would have asked him this. I would have said, is it true? Just a short yes or no. It's either true or it's not true. Were you a principal major owner of Bain Capital? B-A-I-N. Bain Capital.
Right.
He'll say yes or no. If he says no, I have proof that he is and was. That's how he made hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, what exactly did Bain Capital do? Then I would ask him this. Is it true that in 1988, you laid down just $5 million to buy Stage Stores, and then you collected $100 million in stock offerings, but that loaded that company up with so much debt, it went bankrupt in 2000? Yes or no? $5 million got you $100 million. But all those employees lost their job. It's yes or no. Yes, it was $5 million, or no, it wasn't. How difficult is that? He would have had to have said yes, he put up $5 million, and yes, he made $100 million from five. But it cost the company. Then I would say, is it true that in 1992 you bought American Pad and Paper, AMPAD, you put $5 million in, and again, you got $100 million from dividends, but they also went bankrupt in 2000? It's either yes or no. And it would have to be yes. And then in 1993, did you invest $60 million by buying GS Industries, and did you not receive $65 million in dividends? Oh, and didn't they go bankrupt in 2001? And isn't it true that in 1997 you invested $47 million and you bought Details, and you made $93 million in your stock offering? Oh, and didn't they go broke in 2003, bankrupt? So isn't it true that just five businesses, just five, there are more, I'm just saying five, that you made over $578 million and all those went bankrupt and thousands of employees lost their livelihoods?
Wow.
Weren't you also responsible for leading the equity partnership? Do you know what an equity partnership is?
Not really, actually.
Okay. No. An equity partnership works this way. Let's say that you, Elizabeth, you have a company that's been in your family making blue jeans for 80 years.
Right.
And you have 100 employees. But you've practice good marketing and manufacturing standards. Your employees are paid a living wage and get health benefits. They work in a clean and healthy environment. You're not exploiting labor. And you build up a good reputation. So let's say Mitt Romney comes along through his Bell Capital, and they see that you are ripe for the picking. So they go to you. You're making $10 million a year in profit, net profit, after tax profit. They say, we're going to buy you. We're going to give you $50 million. Wow, $50 million? So you think, well, that's good. And you get to stay on in the company. Get to stay as president of the company. And all your employees can stay. You think, what's the catch? Well, the catch is no catch. We're just investing in important companies. But there is a catch. He doesn't tell you. What happens is he goes to Goldman Sachs. And by the way, Goldman Sachs was one of the companies that his company, Bain Investments, used all the time. And Goldman Sachs looks at the paperwork and says, man, this is good for the taking. So Goldman Sachs gives them a bridge loan. So they put down just a little bit of money. There's the scam. They never put up big money. They put down a little bit of money, enough to take control. So they get the title. They now own your company. They are the majority stockholders. They're now the policymakers. Then that money doesn't go into that account as such. Instead, immediately, you get your money. You just sold your company, right?
Right.
You get to stay on for, as president. But almost immediately, they start using every possible credit source to boost up your sales and borrow against it. They borrow $50 million, $100 million. The company that is loaning the money takes 10% off the top, a high amount, a premium fee. And plus they get a certain amount of stock that they can pump and dump immediately. They're not restricted stock. A restricted stock means you have to wait 2 years before you can sell it back in the market.
Right.
They don't have restrictions. So now here's your company that now has $100 million in debt. And where'd all that money go? All the money went to Bell and his partners as dividends. So now they have $50 million in their pocket, and they haven't done a thing except take your company over. But guess who owes the money? Your company. So now they come in and say, we've got to slash wages, slash benefits. There's a pension fund over here. We're going to use it. But that's the employee's retirement pensions. I know, but we can use it. It's ours, technically and legally. And we can have these pants made in China for $3 a pair. Here there's $22 a pair. That gives us a 700% savings. So then first you cut back all your employees. You cut back all their benefits. You sell off profitable divisions. Next thing you know, your company's closed down, and it's now opened up under a different name in China and still selling the product. But now it's gone bankrupt, so they don't owe the $100 million. So they walked away completely debt-free. That's what these people do. That's what Mitt Romney did. Mitt Romney could be disgraced as a person that has caused thousands of people to lose their jobs. He has caused them to... He takes money from people he's never worked a day in his life. He knows nothing about what it is to own an actual business. And remember, he is in the casino capitalism part of Wall Street. They make money, off deals. Whoever can create the most debt wins because they can buy their competition. And that's Mitt Romney.
Right, it's criminal. Okay? Criminal, I mean.
And yet these people, the Diane Sawyers, they throw them idiotic questions. It's an embarrassment. I won't watch that kind of program.
Right.
Okay?
Thank you.
Now to our issue of the day. And this will be hopefully only the one of many that is going to be coming at you. In 1987, I was asked to debate a group of six scientists about the very promising drugs AZT. Signs around New York University Medical School exhorted everyone to, quote, put time on your side, unquote, and the vast majority of activists, including ACT UP, were pushing the government to allocate all available funds to get this drug into as many people as possible who've been diagnosed with AIDS-defining illnesses. I was the only one at this debate who was dissenting, and there was a simple reason. I'd spoken with John Lawrenson. Lawrenson, an investigative journalist who wrote for the New York Native in the 1980s and 90s, knew that AZT was a fraud. Originally a chemotherapy drug that was rejected due to excessive toxicity, AZT was resurrected for use as an AIDS treatment and fast-tracked by the FDA for approval in just 6 months. Lawrenson looked closely at the one single study used as a basis for this approval and found, quote, the description of methodology was incomplete and incoherent. Not a single table was acceptable according to statistical standards. Indeed, not a single table made sense. In particular, the first report on efficacy was marred by contradictions, illogic, and special pleading, unquote. Lawrenson discovered that this poor quality study was unblinded early, allowing both doctors and patients to know whether AZT or the placebo was being taken, thus completely invalidating the study. Then the study itself was terminated early, ostensibly so that all the participants would be able to take AZT, which appeared so effective at preventing death from AIDS. The real-life follow-up, however, at no time repeated the stunning results of this mangled study. Instead, according to Lawrenson, quote, more than 96% of all AIDS deaths occurred after AZT was approved and marketed in 1987. Those deaths were not caused by the HIV virus. They were caused by AZT, the drug, end quote. Lynn Gannett, a researcher overseeing one of the AZT trials in Syracuse, contacted me and showed me reports in private proving everything about the study was a fraud. It was all wrong. She showed me that this entire fast-tracking was all political. It was based on a large push by the pharmaceutical company Burroughs Wellcome and by the AIDS groups that Burroughs Wellcome's foundation was supporting. Gannett said, quote, I was an eyewitness to gross negligence and fraud in the Phase 3 clinical trials of AZT from 1987 to 1990. I've been saying to people for years that AZT was never, I repeat, never proven either safe nor effective. From the particular studies in which I was involved, it would have been impossible to prove anything. The data was such a mess. I now realize that AZT is a deadly poison. All AIDS drug trials since that time have been based on the same flawed model. The big difference is that now there is even less meaningful oversight and even more of an economic incentive for physicians to enroll patients. My belief is that the data which came from the Syracuse site is absolutely worthless. I would never trust my life or my life to the results of this so-called research were in the hands of these so-called medical professionals. The level of medical incompetence, unprofessionalism, unethical, dishonest, corrupt, illegal, and immoral behavior in all of this was shocking and inexcusable. The data was so inaccurate and so full of holes, if there was a rule that could be broken, they broke it. Unquote. Gannett then told me she had attempted to inform everyone in charge of the study, at the National Institutes of Health, at the FDA in North Carolina, of all the violations, not a single person was interested in the gross discrepancies that she had uncovered. And yet she was one of the lead overseers of the whole AZT study. As we would later find out, this drug was devastating. It was one of the most toxic drugs ever created. Yet people were told to take 400 milligrams four times a day. And that was when we began to see otherwise healthy people who had been diagnosed with AIDS dying very quickly. And here's the irony. The more AZT you took, the sicker you got. And the more AZT they told you to take when you were sick. It would be like taking arsenic and getting sick and then being told the remedy is more arsenic. This, to me, was one of the greatest scientific tragedies and frauds in all of history. the number of people who died from taking AZT ended up in the hundreds of thousands. Yet despite this, thousands of new foundations started to emerge promoting AZT, because that's where the money came from. AIDS was redefined as purely a sexually transmitted disease, and people with AIDS were told they had better take AZT or they were going to die. Yet they never looked at people who had been diagnosed with AIDS and HIV infection who weren't taking AZT, but instead were taking a natural approach and were doing just fine. They didn't want to know about that. It came down to dirty politics. If you went to the conferences on AIDS each year, the largest group of people would be the pharmaceutical companies and the AIDS activists who were in reality their supporters and paid supporters. If you were a gay journalist and you did not support this orthodox approach, and I interviewed many, Charles Ortlieb, Nina Ostrom of the New York Native, in my opinion, true American heroes, they were viciously attacked. Not only were you attacked for being an AIDS denialist, but you were attacked for promoting the death of people with AIDS by preventing them from taking the very therapy that were supposedly going to save their lives, AZT. Then all of your funding would dry up, your magazines would not get advertisement, you'd go out of business. In San Francisco, in L.A., no matter where I was, I kept getting the same feedback. And yet the media would not touch this. No one would touch this. The result was only one doctrine, and this became the official doctrine. AZT was promoted by bringing in people, co-opting them, getting them on the payroll, and throwing money everywhere. Money buys allies. It buys alliances, allegiances, access to people who are going to greenlight your views. AZT ended up doing tremendous harm, destroying immune systems and killing people, and yet instead of being withdrawn from the market, the FDA allowed this drug, which had never been proven to be effective or safe, to continue to be sold. Once celebrities such as Sharon Stone and Bono and Elton John and Tom Hanks started endorsing something, and once the President of the United States and the New York Times and the U.S. Surgeon General and the Head of Human Health and Human Services and the National Cancer Institute endorsed it, well, where did that leave you? You could not challenge it, or you immediately are put on the defensive. No one thereafter will ever look objectively or honestly at information at hand. As if we have learned nothing from history, the same drama is unfolding yet again, not with AZT, but with Gardasil. Gardasil, the human papilloma vaccine virus produced by Merck, was brought to market in 2006 with great fanfare, widely proclaimed as the first ever anti-cancer vaccine. Having gained a strong foothold due to a fast tracking by the FDA and rushed to market ahead of completed safety studies and ahead of its competitor, Gardasil was already an entrenched recommended vaccine by the time it was approved. Merck created a market for Gardasil out of thin air with deceptive and dishonest advertising, and thereby planted fear in the minds of consumers. Fear of an unknown health crisis, an invisible time bomb waiting to explode and harm women everywhere. When criticized for their aggressive marketing, Merck countered that they were performing a public service by raising awareness about the human papilloma virus, and they weren't really selling anything. Really? Well, they were lying. This lie became public as Merck was caught lobbying the 50 states for mandatory Gardasil vaccination prior to FDA approval. The fact is that there was never a need for Gardasil in the first place. Regular pap testing and regular gynecological examination had already lowered the incidence of cervical cancer by 80% in the U.S. to a few thousand cases a year, and the vast majority of all human papillomavirus infections resolve of their own accord. But by lining the pockets of such groups as Women in Government, or the National Foundation for Women Legislators, or the National Conference of State Legislators, and of course the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, Merck was able to influence legislation such that almost immediately after the vaccine was approved, it was part of the vaccine schedule recommended for all girls. If it hadn't been for Governor Rick Perry's blatantly self-serving blunder of trying to mandate Gardasil for school attendance in Texas in the face of huge conflict of interest and a $50 million contribution to his presidential campaign, Gardasil might have gone even further. There is something deeply wrong with a giant pharmaceutical company spending hundreds of millions of dollars to manipulate women and influence legislation in order to generate a revenue stream of tens of billions of dollars a year for themselves at the expense of the gullible public. Because what is wrong with Gardasil isn't just that it's unnecessary. Gardasil is possibly the most dangerous vaccine on the market, with the potential to injure, maim, and even kill the children who receive it. The program of coercion to vaccinate every 11 to 26-year-old girl with Gardasil is relentless. This vaccine is given not just in doctors' offices, where doctors have been known to, quote, fire non-compliant patients, but in schools and colleges, where the pressure on girls and young women and their parents to conform can be extreme. These institutions all have quotas, sometimes including financial rewards. They don't tell you about that, do they? And they are anxious to prove high rates of compliance. But there is no informed consent prior to vaccination, so most of these girls and their parents have no idea what they are risking by agreeing to vaccination with Gardasil. While Merck, the FDA, and the CDC and the medical establishment all deny that there have been serious life-altering adverse events associated with Gardasil, the fact is that compared with mandated vaccines, which are given with greater frequency, Gardasil has the most adverse events reported to the vaccine adverse reporting system of any vaccine. And since reporting of adverse events is not mandatory in the United States, it is likely that only at maximum 10% of bad events are ever actually reported. And what are the victims of Merck's war on cervical cancer? Alexis Wolf was a normal seventh grader in 2007. She had type 1 diabetes, but had successfully learned how to give herself insulin shots and eventually graduated to an insulin pump, which she had mastered easily. Alexis made the honor roll for the first time that year and was rewarded with a trip to Germany over the summer to visit her grandparents. Her endocrinologist believed that the diabetes was under control and felt Alexis would be perfectly capable of making the trip on her own and managing her diabetes herself. To make sure everything was in order prior to travel, Alexis' doctor recommended she receive her first Gardasil vaccine. The trip went well, but Alexis seemed different to her mother when she returned, perhaps a bit distant. Alexis received her second Gardasil vaccine after coming home, and shortly thereafter her personality changed entirely. For a relatively shy girl, Alexis immediately became very gregarious, hugging everyone all the time. But she also became agitated, troubled, and started having difficulty keeping food down. It reached the point where she threw up a number of times a day, which is especially dangerous for diabetic. There began a series of appointments with many, many different doctors, the GP, the endocrinologist, the cardiologist, the gastroenterologist, and numerous other diagnostic tests. But nothing they did or recommended seemed to help. Alexis was struggling to get through her days, usually carrying a bucket with her at all times, just in case. She had terrible insomnia, was eating excessively, and falling further and further behind in school. In January of 2008, Alexis received her third Gardasil shot. Within 2 weeks, she was in the hospital. Her behavior had worsened to the point where she was considered bipolar, and she was put on a series of antipsychotic medications. Her mother didn't believe that this was a psychological problem. She knew that something else had to be wrong, knew that there had to be some medical explanation for what was going on. After weeks and months in and out of different hospitals, with no improvement and her condition growing more desperate, Alexis, at long last, was seen by a doctor who recognized that she was having seizures, something all the previous doctors had overlooked. This led to more tests, EEGs, MRI imaging, and spinal taps, and finally a conclusion that seemed to make sense: encephalitis, traumatic brain injury, and seizure disorder. But why? Alexis' mother had an additional conclusion which was so crystal clear in hindsight. Her daughter was normal, completely normal, before she received the three Gardasil vaccines, and with each one, she had worsened. The Gardasil vaccine had left Alexis with brain damage. We spoke with Tracy Wolf, Alexis's mother, about their ordeal. While maintaining a cheerful optimism, Tracy admitted that she never could have foreseen how their lives would have been changed completely after Alexis' seizure disorder was identified and she was put on anti-seizure medications, her physical symptoms improved to a certain extent, but she was completely altered. Alexis had deteriorated from being a normal child to one who was only functioning at a fourth grade level, forced into special education instead of rejoining her previous class. Alexis became enormously frustrated and school became an ordeal for everyone. Since Alexis turned 18, Tracy finally gave up and pulled her out of school, realizing there really was nothing that could be done. The stress on their family has been enormous. Pressure caused the Wolf's marriage to dissolve, and Tracy is now raising both her daughters by herself, with her father living in a different state. Alexis needs almost constant medical supervision, and Tracy can only leave her home for a few minutes at a time. They have applied for special services that could possibly help, but there's a long waiting list, and Alexis doesn't understand why things are so different, why her little sister is learning to drive, but she can't. In conversations with William Ronan, a lawyer retained by Alexis's family, he shared his law firm's current handling of 15 to 18 Gardasil cases that are being evaluated and another six cases already filed in the vaccine court. Gardasil-related injuries all fall into two main categories, autoimmune and neurological. Since 1986, all cases of vaccine injury must be brought to the Office of Special Master at the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, commonly called the Vaccine Court. This court was established to create a non-adversarial situation in which children injured by vaccines could receive compensation, but the Department of Health and Human Services has completely distorted the intent of this legislation and turned it into a highly adversarial proceeding. Injuries listed on a table are supposed to be automatically compensated, but they have removed a lot of the injuries from the table over the years and have listed new vaccines such as Gardasil with no specific injuries attributable to vaccine. So the burden is on the victim to prove causation because there is no presumption of any injury. The cases are slow going. Evidence of harm caused by vaccines is crucial, but there aren't a lot of published medical studies about safety. Those that exist are funded by the manufacturer and tend to be overly favorable. The best, most helpful study that Roman has seen so far was published very recently, and he is hopeful that this will signal the start of more studies that discuss the severe injuries attributable to Gardasil. The very concept of vaccine injury is highly controversial, but to say that this is a battle between the anti-vaccine activists against the more reasonable and sane individuals to him isn't a fair statement. Ronan does not consider himself to be anti-vaccine, but he has seen too many girls have serious adverse reactions to Gardasil. The injuries are frequently neurological, and when doctors can't put their fingers on what's wrong, they end up sending the girls to a psychiatrist. Needless to say, then they're put on medications that don't help them. But Runa maintains that it is impossible for all these girls suddenly to have developed mental problems or simply to be imagining that they have been harmed since receiving Gardasil vaccines. He runs a two-person law firm in Kansas City, and without advertising, he received about 30 calls regarding Gardasil injuries. It's just the tip of the iceberg. Rona maintains that one of the strongest arguments against Merck is their failure to adequately warn girls of the risks involved when getting the Gardasil vaccine. Merck clearly knew that this drug could cause neurological dysfunction, yet did not adequately address this in the product insert. Also, it is known that girls who receive human papilloma or papilloma virus are more likely to be harmed by the vaccine, but the manufacturer does not make this clear and does not recommend testing. According to Ronan, quote, the real issue is, what is the benefit of this vaccine? Do the benefits outweigh the risks? There is a risk of a seizure disorder or autoimmune disorder versus the benefit that it might reduce cervical cancer. But Gardasil doesn't eliminate the need for regular pap testing, which is already safe, and there isn't good evidence that it prevents cervical cancer. The vaccine. In evaluating risk and benefit, when all the facts are known, it becomes a pretty easy decision. The vaccine is more dangerous than any benefit. Unfortunately, medical professionals tend to read and listen to information provided by the manufacturers, which doesn't adequately present the risks involved, so they actually aren't sufficiently informed to advise their patients, end quote. Ronan's own daughter had to fight off an aggressive attempt by her doctor to get the Gardasil vaccine, so he understands the pressure the girls are under to just go along instead of asking questions. We interviewed last week Dr. Merrill Nass, board-certified internal medicine practitioner and vaccine specialist, who agrees that Gardasil was rushed to market without adequate testing first. The company likewise has funded no new testing despite continuing to widen the target audience for the vaccine. When Gardasil was approved by the FDA, deferred any studies in males under 18, and yet 3 years later they approved the product for boys ages 9 and above. We know that no studies were begun 3 years earlier, and there's probably very little data when it was approved for boys. Regarding Gardasil's adverse effects, Dr. Nass says, quote, children don't usually die suddenly when they are healthy, but there are certainly lots of teenage girls who have died suddenly after Gardasil or developed severe neurological reactions. Therefore, if you're going to try to balance safety and efficacy when you prescribe something like a vaccine, you have to know how effective it's going to be. Does this really prevent cervical cancer in young women? Does it prevent it in women who've already been exposed to these viruses? So I don't know how other doctors prescribe something like Gardasil. Basically, make an assumption that the FDA has licensed it. The manufacturer would only market something that's safe, right? Doctors go ahead and prescribe. Okay. But what if they're all wrong? There's extremely toxic reactions to this vaccine. Gardasil's doctrine is already so entrenched after only 6 years that it's a formidable task to challenge the official story that the vaccine is safe and effective, because the truth is too unsettling. The remarkable claims of Gardasil's benefits to women in the war on cancer are full of just lies and so many holes and not supported by good science, even that science funded by Merck itself. It is important to deconstruct the falsehoods and half-truths that masquerade as facts about Gardasil. First, now here's where it gets interesting. There is no human papillomavirus health crisis. You heard me right. Cervical cancer in the United States has been at a record low for the past 20 years. Currently, only 3,600 women die of cervical cancer each year. The spectacular success in lowering the death rate from cervical cancer can be attributed to the annual Pap screening. Between 1955 and 1992, deaths from cervical cancer declined 74% and then declined an additional 4%. Part of the success of Pap screening lies in the fact that cervical cancer, unlike most other cancers, is very slow growing. With screening, there is ample opportunity to catch and successfully treat cervical cancer before it gets out of hand. Next, human papillomavirus infection does not usually lead to cancer. They're lying. They're saying just the opposite. It is estimated that virtually all women in the United States experience a series of human papillomavirus infections throughout their lifetimes. All women. What the makers of Gardasil try to hide is the well-documented fact that 90% of all human papillomavirus infections go away of their own accord within 2 years without causing any disease and no treatment or intervention of any kind. Third, Gardasil does not prevent cancer, yet most women and adults take it because they believe it does prevent cancer. It does not. The end point of all efficacy studies for Gardasil was not prevention of cancer. Researchers couldn't actually assess the development of cervical cancer following the vaccine because it normally takes up to 40 years to develop, and their study stopped after a few years. So instead, Merck scientists decided that the presence of atypical cervical cells was a valid substitute for cancer. They used this hypothesis, underline hypothesis, of atypical cervical cells as the evidence when there was no evidence that this type of cervical lesions they chose as their endpoint could eventually lead to cancer. I consider this fraudulent science. Merck has never acknowledged that their entire premise of the efficacy of Gardasil, therefore all the governors, including Christie, get that through your head, and all the legislators, if they have a brain in their head, have been lied to. Let me repeat this. The manufacturer never, ever, ever proved that Gardasil would prevent cervical cancer, because Gardasil rests on pure speculation. In fact, many, if not most, atypical cervical cells resolve on their own without intervention. That's the actual science. Also, Gardasil is not 90% effective at preventing high-grade cervical lesions, as they claim. Results of Merck's efficacy study, published in 2007, article in the New England Journal of Medicine, claimed that Gardasil is, quote, 90% effective at preventing high-grade cervical lesions. But the article itself reveals that Merck manipulated the data by excluding women and girls who did not follow the exact protocol. When all women in the study were considered, vaccine efficacy dropped to 44%. But even these numbers only actually reflect cervical lesions associated with human papillomavirus 16 and 18. When Merck looked at Gardasil's ability to prevent all cervical lesions, Gardasil was only 17% effective. And again, their definition of effective rests solely on the unfounded assumption that certain types of cervical lesions turn into cancer, and that's not scientifically valid. More damning is Merck's own acknowledgement that in their controlled studies, a percentage of girls actually developed serious cervical lesions after they took Gardasil. The vaccines seemed to cause the most lesions in girls with pre-existing human papillomavirus 16 and 18 infections, but also in girls who had no pre-existing human papilloma infections. At the very least, screening of girls for human papilloma 16 and 18 infections would give human papillomavirus positive girls the chance to avoid developing cervical lesions by declining the vaccine. Yet not only does Merck not recommend testing for human papilloma prior to vaccination with Gardasil, they have actually discouraged this practice, presumably so as not to draw attention to the danger. Anything to maintain the fantasy that this is safe and effective as a vaccine. Also, Gardasil does not prevent human papillomavirus. Gardasil is designed to prevent only four human papilloma strains, 16 and 18, which can cause cervical cancer, and 6 and 11, which can cause genital warts. However, there are 150 other types of human papillomaviruses, at least 15 of which can cause cancer. And Gardasil provides zero protection against these other 15 strains. Does Merck's so-called consumer education ever mention any of this? Of course not. Why would you have your daughter vaccinated if you knew the protection was so limited? Vaccine manufacturers don't appear to consider that the human body, the immune system, and the world of viruses are in constant state of seeking balance. And while Gardasil may lower the incidence of these four particular human papilloma strains, there are numerous examples where vaccines targeting only one or two strains out of hundreds that exist have actually created an increase in previously underrepresented virus strains, such as with the meningococcal pneumococcus and the hemophilus influenza B vaccines. In each of these cases, the overall incidence of disease has stayed the same, while different strains of each of the viruses has increased in virulence to make up for the strains targeted by the vaccines, a biological zero-sum game. How does Merck know that the same thing won't happen with Gardasil? Meanwhile, vaccine manufacturers scramble to increase the number of strains targeted by their vaccines in a futile attempt to stay one step ahead of Mother Nature. Also, vaccinating prepubescent girls with Gardasil will not protect them against human papillomavirus or cervical cancer. Despite the sanctimonious advertising, which suggests that both mother and daughters can empower themselves through Gardasil, Merck's own studies show that the vaccine is only effective for 5 years. So if your 11-year-old daughter gets Gardasil vaccines, it will have stopped working by the time she's 16 and may become sexually active. But since Merck doesn't give out this information voluntarily, these girls and their mothers will be in the dark. In portraying Gardasil as a treatment that will prevent 90% of cervical cancer, the strong implication is that vaccinated girls will no longer be at risk of cervical cancer at all. As we have already seen in Finland, this can lead to the false assumption that there is no longer a need for annual pap testing. When women in Finland stopped getting pap screens, cervical cancer increased 400% in only 5 years. This complacency about risk, started and fostered by Gardasil's advertising, is also likely to lead to an actual increase in cervical cancer in the United States as more females receive the vaccine and stop actions that would have proven to be protective. There is no evidence that Gardasil is effective in boys at preventing genital warts and anal cancer. Merck's study on human papillomavirus vaccine efficacy in males, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, states that Gardasil is 89% effective against genital warts and 75% effective against anal cancer. Given the fact that there are approximately 300 annual deaths from anal rectal cancer among men in the United States, one wonders how Merck was able to prove such a huge reduction in such a rare problem. As with the female group, external lesions substituted for actual cancer, with no proof that lesions of that type actually lead to cancer at all. Yet Merck's statistics regarding their cancer substitute and listed in their appendix to the article show that in men who did not have human papillomavirus prior to vaccination, both the vaccinated group and the placebo group had the same number of these types of lesions, making the observed efficacy of Gardasil minus 98%. And with human papilloma strain 18 related genital lesions, there was actually more lesions in the vaccinated group than the placebo group. So as to the previous study, Merck's impressive numbers that the efficacy of Gardasil in men can only be attained by excluding one quarter of the study participants. When everyone is included and all outcomes are assessed, the efficacy drops to zero. And in conclusion, most significantly, Gardasil has been associated with an unacceptable number of life-altering adverse events following vaccination. According to the World Health Organization data, rates of serious adverse reactions reported to the VAERS system is 250% higher than the current age standardized death rate from cervical cancer. That shows that Gardasil has been associated with 24,184 adverse events since its debut in 2006, including seizures, anaphylaxis, paralysis, transverse myelitis, Lou Gehrig's disease, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, and other serious conditions, including loss of vision and postural tachycardia syndrome, facial palsy, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, chronic fatigue syndrome, blindness, pancreatitis, speech problems, short-term memory loss, miscarriage, multiple sclerosis, autoimmune disorders, abnormal pap smears, and even cervical cancer. Yes, you heard me right. The federal government's reporting 41 cases of cervical cancer following vaccination with Gardasil. Also, while Merck has not made pregnancy a contraindication for Gardasil vaccination, recent data released revealed that Gardasil is by far the most dangerous vaccine to receive while pregnant, having caused more than 1,300 adverse reactions in its 5 years compared to the next most dangerous vaccine frequently given to pregnant women, the flu vaccine, which has caused 200 adverse events over 20 years. Gardasil vaccination while pregnant has also been associated with both frequent miscarriage and high rates of birth defects. But most tragically, as of just a month and a half ago, four more deaths have been added to the Gardasil toll, bringing the tally to 108 deaths due to Gardasil vaccine. The vaccine against human papillomavirus was completely superfluous to women's health from its inception. As if the unreasonable risk associated with this vaccine weren't enough, Gardasil is also the most expensive recommended vaccine on the market, $120 to $150 per injection, and three are required. If this vaccine becomes mandated for all schools, which Alec and other groups are trying, how are poor people and the uninsured to come up with the money? And as funding for government programs dries up, does it make any sense to take limited state health care dollars to vaccinate Medicaid-eligible girls instead of using the money for something that actually might benefit them? I'm Gary Noll. That's our first report of the year. Gardasil, child abuse by a vaccine. Thank you for listening.